The Athletic.
The Phil Hay Show.
Hello there, welcome to the show. The Phil Hay Show is brought to you by The Athletic and The Square Ball. Get in touch with the show via the new Twitter account at The Phil Hay Show. My name's Dan Moylan, hello, joined by my colleague from The Square Ball, Michael Normanton.
Hello.
Phil Hay completing his recovery from his surgery at the end of April. If you've been listening across the summer, you'll know we recorded a top 10 signings feature that's been running across the last few weeks. We are on to Phil's number 4 today, so you will still hear Phil's voice on the podcast for the next few weeks. While Phil is off, we're having guests in from the world of Leeds United. We're going to hear from Bryn Law in just a little bit. And look out, next week, we've got John Richardson coming on the show. In the meantime, a quick reminder that you can sign up to The Athletic for a special price for the Euros, £1 a month for 6 months, £6 to pay between now and the end of the year for access to the very best sports writing anywhere, including that excellent coverage of Leeds United. Head to theathletic.com/LeedsPod to sign up. Before we speak to Bryn Law then, in just a little bit, let's get a very special guest here on The Phil Hay Show. Phil Hay!
Hello! Back from the abyss.
Oh, thank God. Thank God. It's so good to hear your voice, Phil. Thank God. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. I'm very well. Thanks for inviting me on. It's about time. I've been skiving for 2 months and kicking my heels. So no, it's nice to be back. I'm in one piece. The staples are out. The scar's kind of going slowly, little by little getting there. So yeah, feeling great.
Boyish good looks maintained.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I was kind of hoping with the staples that I might get a bit of a Game of Thrones look, but actually it's a bit tame and there's not too much to see. So an extra in that series is out of the question.
Well, it's good to know that you're in one piece, and we've got to start with the obvious question. Any news, Phil?
You were going to ask me about Rodrigo de Paul, weren't
Who?
You?
Who?
And I've been thinking of you for the last fortnight as this move to Atletico Madrid was getting going. tell me honestly, who was the card from? Rodrigo de Paul card?
My birthday card. That was from my mum. She listens, and she thought that would be funny to do, to send one from Rodrigo de Paul.
As mother's jokes go, that's pretty good, I think.
It is, isn't it? But yeah, so how are things in the world of Leeds United? Have you been keeping in touch?
I have. I mean, I was in hospital for 12 nights after the op. So I watched a few of the games in there and caught up with the rest of them at home. Was very, very impressed, actually, with the way they finished off the season. If anything, they seemed to be getting stronger while other teams were kind of wrapping up for the summer. I thought it was good to see Rodrigo coming good in that little spell. I thought it was great to see the way they outplayed Spurs at Elland Road. It's been quite quiet since then, but I mean, it's one of those where there's a lot of stuff bubbling in the background. Player contracts, Bielsa's contract, obviously, which will come at some stage, but him being him never comes at a rate of knots. And I think we will, before long, start to see a bit of movement with signings as well. But I don't think it's going to be a highly dramatic summer. Everybody seems pretty content with where the club are at. And, you know, I think everybody feels pretty content about the shape they're in going into next season.
Just to clarify why you are back on this show, we should probably explain that you are just coming on just for the first part of this show, just to make sure that your brain and your mouth still works.
It's a good test. That was actually one of the few side effects I had in the days after the operation was that I found that my mouth was moving more slowly than my brain. So I was finding it difficult to keep up with my thought process while I was talking. But yeah, I'll probably be back into the mix in some guys middle of next month, and then I think back for real for the start of the season at the beginning of August, which, to be honest, I'm really looking forward to, because I'm starting to get twitchy now and starting to get a little bit bored, despite the freedom that you have with this.
Back before Adam Forshaw. That's the aim, Phil.
Well, you never know. You never know.
So have you been keeping in touch then with all the Leedsy stuff, like, you know, contacts and whatnot, while you've been sat at home twiddling your thumbs?
Little bits and pieces. I mean, for three, four weeks, I left it alone completely, with the exception of watching the games. But yeah, I mean, people keep in touch with you as much as anything else. So you still hear what's going around. I keep an eye on the news, obviously, and we've got guys at The Athletic who are covering things as they happen. I mean, it's been pretty much what we expected. Obviously, Alioski is still up in the air, and Bielsa will sign when he gets round to it and when everything's right. And I think we'll probably see players in most of the positions that we expected to see players coming in, particularly at left back. That'll still be the priority for them. But yeah, no, I have as best I can. And I've always tried to remember at the back of my head that at some point I'll need to get back into this. So I could do with being vaguely informed when I get started again, which would be for the best, I think.
And messaging out, coming out of the club seems to be fairly consistent all round. We spoke to Angus and Victor on this show in your absence, and it seems to be a kind of a quality over quantity when it comes to signings, and left-back midfielder winger seems to be the overarching message.
I still think those are the three that it sounds like they will do. I think definitely left-back and definitely centre-mid. I suspect with a winger, it will depend who's out there and how far the budget will stretch. And I guess we'll see as well whether or not Kessié sticks around this summer. Although I thought it was quite revealing what Bielsa said and what he did towards the end of last season playing Kessié. And speaking again in his defence, he obviously thinks really highly of him and he obviously wants him around the club. And Kessié's, still under contract. He's on a high wage, but now that they're in the Premier League, it's not, comparatively as high as it was percentage-wise in the Championship. So if he sticks around, I think we'll probably be looking at 2-3 at first-team level as it is. And then there'll be players coming in at under-23, under-18 level as well, which seems to now be a bit of an annual event at Leeds. They do like to attack the youth market and they do like to keep that squad ticking over. And given how strong it is already, it's not going to be a bad thing at all if they make additions to that, which I'm sure they will.
And as a proud Scotsman, have you been enjoying the Euros then? Did you celebrate the 0-0 against England at Wembley like some of your fellow countrymen?
Immensely. You see, I was one of those people who realised that Scotland had qualified through the back door, so to speak, and I had very limited expectations for them and even lower still after the first game against the Czech Republic. I mean, to my mind, that was the one that did it, the kind of refusal to go too up front and to be overly ambitious in that game. That was the game that Scotland had to win. They did play well against England, although I thought it was a strange night for the English. They seemed to be very low on energy towards the end of the game and I didn't feel like they were playing for a point because they thought a point would be a good result, in the latter stages. I thought they were playing for a point because they didn't seem to have a huge amount left in their legs. But I'd probably say the same about Scotland certainly in the second half against Croatia. And again, tactically, they just weren't there. They were really limited. It was very long ball. They got absolutely murdered by Modric, who had all the space he needed to play in. And it's over. So what is it they're estimating? 2036 will be the next time you see me? Yeah, something like that.
Do you see parallels with what happened with Leeds in the Championship a little bit with Scotland's performance against England? I mentioned over on the Square Ball podcast that it had echoes for me of, like, say, the Wigan game, for example, games where England were expected to win, England being Leeds United in this example, and Scotland being Wigan. I don't know if that's an unfair comparison, but you know what I mean? Like, so Wigan came and gave it their all, absolutely ran their legs off. And like we've seen with so many other teams as well, the game afterwards, it costs the team that's faced Leeds.
Yeah, potentially. Although I think England played poorly on the Friday night, if I'm being honest. And as good as Scotland were, it was unlikely. I always felt that Croatia would get better than they were in their very first game against England. It was hard to tell on the night how much of a factor nervousness was for England. I'd be surprised if it was a hugely significant. There was a crowd, but it wasn't massive. And I don't think the crowd was particularly difficult with them. They just didn't really seem to get going. And I think they definitely do have a problem in the sense that Harry Kane looks out of sorts and looks leggy and doesn't look anywhere near his best. And given that the team, to some extent, has been built around him or has been built with him as a very main focal point, it is a concern. But I've got to say, this game coming up now, England-Germany, is an absolute cracker. And needless to say, like a bit of a glory hunter, I'll slip back into the England camp and claim English relatives and everything else, much to the frustration of my old colleague at the Evening Post, Steve Ryden, who is 100% convinced that I'm 100% Scottish.
I'm surprised that you say that, actually. I think I imagine most Scots would be going for Germany in this one.
Well, I've got a lot of English blood, you know. Both my parents are English, and obviously I've lived down here now for 20-odd years, and kids are English, wife's English and everything else. So I don't really fall into the camp of anybody but England, and I don't have a huge allegiance to Germany either. So, no, it would suit me quite happily if the English went through. I have to be honest, though, I can't call this game on Tuesday. Both teams seem to be very in and out. But having watched the Germans last night, I think from England's point of view, it's very winnable.
What do you make of Liam Cooper's contribution to Scotland then? Bit of a bit part player, really.
Yeah, he was. That one game, first game, and then obviously switched to back three, which meant that there was no room for him. I thought it was slightly odd against Croatia that When Hanley came off, it wasn't Cooper that came on. It was Scott McKenna instead. It seemed to me that of the two of them, Cooper is the better player. I'm pleased for him that he's had some international recognition and some international experience, because he's obviously featured. I think I'm right in saying, although mine might be tricking me here, I think he featured in our list of top 10 signings, and he's been great value for Leeds, and he's also captained them through the best period in the club's history of the past 20 years. So he's, you know, he is at that level where I think he's good enough to play in tournaments like this. But I suspect he'll come home a bit disappointed that his involvement was as limited as it was.
Do you think he'll have an appetite to stick it out for the next World Cup, which is what, winter 2022, isn't it? Next winter, so in 18 months time or thereabouts.
It's a good question, because he's creeping into his 30s, and that's the point at which players always have to make a decision about how much weight they're going to put on international football or whether they need to concentrate a bit more on club football. I don't think 30 is a particularly old age these days for a footballer. And I would think he's got life left in him yet. I think the bigger question will be, is there much prospect of Scotland qualifying for the World Cup? And if they don't, you're talking, you know, another 2 years down the line to the next Euros after that, at which point he's obviously getting older and other players will be coming through. So it may well be that this has been his one and only opportunity. But it would surprise me with him if at this age he was ready to give up on it yet.
What have you made of Calvin's form for England then?
Very good. Very good. But I don't think any of us are shocked by that at all. And Phillips is one of those characters who is inherently confident and inherently laid back, doesn't seem to suffer from tension at all, doesn't seem to suffer from imposter syndrome. So as he moves up the divisions or moves into international football, clearly thinks that he's good enough to cope with it. Really, really impressed with him against Croatia. My only concern with him in the sort of advanced midfield role, and in that position, he was actually doing a lot of what he tries to do with Leeds, a lot of ball winning, you know, a lot of good sort of searching passes. But there was always the risk that with him and Rice in the team together, that at some point that wasn't going to work, and at some point it wouldn't be quite adventurous or attacking enough. And I still think that if you're giving Phillips his best position, you're playing him as a four in front of the defence. But he's, you know, he's very, very quickly pushed himself into a position where he is, you know, pretty much first choice. He is a starting player now for England, which is pretty incredible when you think that he's only had one season in the Premier League, and you know where he was at, like a lot of other players at Leeds prior to Bielsa coming in. So I think we were mentioning Liam Cooper there and what the future holds for him internationally, and saying it's quite difficult to predict. I think this tournament will cement Phillips' place as an England player for a while longer yet, regardless of what happens in this tournament and regardless of what happens with Southgate. I think the way he plays for Leeds and the way he plays under Bielsa and the way he's improved under Bielsa as well makes him an obvious go-to player for any England coach.
And Clicky is going to get a bit of a rest. I mean, I know we'd always like to see our players progress through the tournament and keep an eye on them, but if there's one man who needs to put his feet up, I would argue it's Matthijs Clicky.
Yeah, absolutely. And he, you know, he had that week off at the end of the season. He was quoted himself back sort of February, March time as saying that it had caught up on him a little bit this season, and he did feel like he was jaded and that he was suddenly starting to sense how much football was in his legs and how much he'd played over 2 years with Bielsa. I still think he's a cracking player, and I still think he's a player who needs to be a central part of this squad at Leeds, but it won't do him any harm. He'll get a little bit of time off now, the same as all the players who are playing in the Euros. The bulk of the squad are doing some testing towards the back end of next week in Leeds. They'll start training the following Monday. They'll get into it properly, and then at some stage a little bit further down the line, your players who've been away at the Euros will return as well. But yeah, I think a few weeks of R&R would be good for him.
Have you had a steer on Alioski then? Because he's now done with North Macedonia, on his way to have a rest. I mean, it's now the 24th of June as we record this. His contract is up inside the next week. What is he going to do?
Well, they are still in contact and the offer is still on the table, but I don't think Leeds are minded to increase it. I think they feel like they've made him a fair offer, which kind of reflects his ability and reflects his valuation and where he's at in his career. Alioski or Alioski's camp are given the impression that he does have other offers and he does have alternatives, and they haven't taken the contract proposal from Leeds as yet. So it's very difficult to call. And I think at the end of the season, Leeds felt fairly confident that he would sign, because he'd indicated to them that he would be going, and then there were further talks with Victor Orta after the season finished, and Orta came away from that, I think, very hopeful that Alioski might about turn a little bit and might think, do you know what, I'd be better off staying here. This is probably the right decision. But there's been no movement since then. Obviously, Alioski has been away at the Euros, which hasn't helped. But at the moment, showing no sign of jumping on this offer. And I don't know, in all honesty, whether Leeds have set a deadline for him. I don't know what they're thinking time-wise. I think if he doesn't sign, they would probably look to add a little bit more cover on the left-hand side beyond the left-back that they're trying to sign, the first-choice left-back. But they'd like him to stay, and that's why the contract offer is on the table. It's there for him to take if he wants. But I don't think this is one that they can allow to drag on indefinitely. I don't imagine Bielsa would want it to drag on indefinitely. I would assume that Bielsa would want a commitment from Alioski by the time that the players who've been away at the Euros are expected to be back and starting pre-season. So I think at the moment I would sway a little bit towards Alioski going elsewhere. But for as long as the option of staying is in front of him, you can never say never.
In terms of off-the-field matters, we've seen a bit of shifting on the training ground as well. The plan to locate at the Matthew Murray site just across the motorway from Elland Road now being shelved because that's where the park life scheme is going to allow for more space to build on Fullerton Park for a brand new West Stand, and Leeds going up to 55,000.
There has been a shift in attitude towards this, I think, over the past 12 months. If you think back to the point where they were first discussing the sports hub at Fullerton Park and the training ground and potentially stadium expansion as well. The stadium expansion was always the thing that was spoken about as the kind of longer term goal and spoken about as potential, because Leeds and Angus Kinnear in particular realised that in order to do that, they had to be established in the Premier League. It wasn't just enough to be promoted. If they were struggling in the Premier League, or if worst case scenario, they were relegated again, it was in nobody's interest to be left with an expensive project and to be left with a stadium with a capacity that wasn't going to be used. So they would have had space in the ground for the sports hub at Fullerton Park last August if it hadn't been for COVID. There was a lot of attention given to the training ground project. Kinnear has got, you know, artist impressions for the Matthew Murray site on his laptop. The funding was clearly something that needed to be sorted out, but they were very insistent that it was sensible to be based in the city centre so that you were making the training ground far more accessible for inner city kids. You know, that it wasn't a kind of exclusive retreat at Thorpe Arch that really you needed parents who could drive you there, that, you know, public transport was difficult. It seemed to them that if they were to tap in properly to the core of kids who play football in Leeds, they'd be far better doing it by having a training ground in the city centre. But over the past 12 months, and you have noticed this with Angus when you've had him on the show, I think, and certainly I have from speaking to him, more and more attention has been paid to the stadium itself. And little by little, there's become this feeling that actually the priority is to make Elland Road bigger above all else. They know that a capacity of 36,000 is not enough. It was interesting reading Kinnear's comments in a matchday programme earlier in the season where he said that down at Tottenham, their match day revenue is five times higher per game than it is at Elland Road. And that's a really significant commercial difference. And as we've seen with Radrizzani over the time he's been owner, one of the big focuses and one of the big jobs has been to increase the commercial and corporate performance and to hike up the revenue as much as possible. So that really has jumped to the top of the list. And because they've seen that Bielsa has been more than up to the standard of the Premier League, the squad have been more than up to the standard of the Premier League, because they feel very content with the plan as it is, and because everybody feels very settled and very happy with Bielsa and his team, I think they feel that the time is right to expand the stadium and also to expand it in a way which gets it to the right size. There's very little point in expanding it if you find a little further down the line that actually you still don't have enough space. It's almost impossible to do twice. So it sounds as if the sports hub will move over to the Matthew Murray site. Elland Road will expand back onto Fullerton Park, and I think there'll be some work done on the north stand. And I suspect from what Kinnear was saying a while back as well, they will probably try to upgrade the south stand, although because they've got Elland Road behind it, I don't think there's much they can do with the capacity of that, or not to any great extent. But that looks, you know, everybody seems to be on board with that. Radrizzani, the 49ers, and that looks like it will be the next thing in terms of infrastructure or major infrastructure. That looks like it will be the next thing coming down the track.
Well, we'll watch all that with keen interest, Phil, and we look forward to having you back on the show in a few weeks' time. Go away and continue your recuperation. get back on the first team pitch and all the rest of it. And we'll see you in a couple of weeks, hopefully.
Lovely, yes. I will see you soon.
Joining us now on the Phil Hay Show, well, we heard from a dour, upset, sad Scotsman before. Presumably this is going to be a happy Welshman in the form of Bryn Law. Welcome to the show.
Happy-ish. Welcome. Thanks. I mean, yeah, deal.
Presumably you've been enjoying this tournament up to a point.
Yes and no is the answer to that. The yes is the performances. The no is I should have been there. I had tickets for both games in Baku. I had a ticket for Rome. And I've ended up going to none of the matches. I've been watching them in the Lamb Flag in Leeds. So that's the disappointment. But in terms of from a distance watching, yeah, I've enjoyed it so far.
For my part, I've enjoyed seeing the pictures of you enjoying it in Leeds anyway.
That's what we can do.
And I like the picture from the Lamb and Flag of the terrace and everything. And there's some people obviously just trying to have a nice quiet dinner at the side of you all watching it. How many people have you got down there for?
Well, we've been getting about 15 down there. And we're talking now ahead of the Denmark game. And I think we're going to have our best turnout yet for that one. Because word's gone around. But it's been quite heartening, actually. And people have we've had the same people coming. We've got a core group who've been coming. Not all of whom I know as well, by the way, which is good. I've got to know them a little bit over the course of the three games, but we had others joining us at various times as well. So yeah, we've had 15 is the most, I think, so far, but I think we might be looking to exceed that figure for this next one. Because what happened with the Euros last time, which we'll probably talk about a bit more about in a moment, but what happened with the Euros last time was basically everybody was really into it, went. So I was there for all the games. Some of the lads that I'm watching the matches within the Lamb and Flag were all Leeds-based. We're all out in France for the Euros. So we went. We've not had the opportunity to do that this time. So we've been looking for a suitable alternative. And the suitable alternative to me isn't sitting in the living room watching it on the telly. You know, the only person in the house who's interested because nobody else in the family, you know, gives a toss, basically. So that isn't the alternative for me. I want some sort of shared experience, at least if I can't be at the matches. And clearly, with the Dutch authorities now having literally banned Wales fans from the next game, you know, that's not happening, sort of thing.
It's interesting hearing you say that, because when we've spoken in recent months talking about the experience of being in empty stadia, how important the shared experience is for you, because that's one of the things you spoke about at length about the last Euros, because you did a book about it as well.
I did, yeah, yeah. I did two books based around the fact that, first of all, Wales qualified. So that was when I was working for Sky as the Wales reporter. So I did all the games from that sort of correspondence perspective, but also being a fan as well, lifelong fan. So that was that story, if you like. And then for that summer, when we'd finally got there in 2016, I decided that I didn't want to work on it. There were a number of reasons for that, but amongst them being that Sky had no rights to any of the tournament, and that makes a massive difference in terms of the type of access that you get to the tournament. You're literally kept out of the stadium footprint if you haven't got rights to it on a match day. So I'd been on the pitch in Bosnia when Wales qualified, and I was going to go from being on the pitch with the players to not even being allowed in the car park technically, you know, on a match day sort of thing. So I didn't really want to go from one position to the other. And more than that, I just wanted to go and watch it as a fan. That's all I'd ever wanted, was to go and support Wales in a summer tournament, and I'd finally got the opportunity. So I didn't want to be at the, you know, beholden to somebody else saying, we need you outside there, standing up at 7 a.m, you know, to talk about blah, blah, blah. I didn't want any of that. So I booked, as soon as we qualified, I booked 2 weeks holiday, just 2 weeks holiday, just to make sure that nobody at Sky could sort of ring up and say, oh, we need you to do this. So I've already booked the holiday. So as soon as that got squared off, the holiday request, that was me into full preparation mode from that point onwards. And of course, 2 weeks became 3 weeks, became nearly a month, as it turned out. I was fine all the way through it. I continued to do the fan thing. So, I mean, it was, and as you'll have heard it, this phrase bandied around constantly in the build-up to this championships. But for anybody who was there, it was the best summer of their lives. I can say that without fear of contradiction. It was just brilliant.
Does that give you a problem this time around? Because
yeah,
you just know it's not going to be, you'll never get that high again.
It was already not going to be. If you took COVID out the entire situation, the tournament was an absolute nonsense. It's ridiculous. It made no sense then. It makes even less sense now. So we were already looking, as soon as the draw came out and we ended up having qualified, which was great. And I was there the night we beat Hungary to qualify. So enjoyed all of that. Not working on the Wales games anymore, but, you know, back there as a fan. Enjoyed all of that bit. And then we got the draw, and then the fixtures were allocated, and we ended up in Baku. So Wales is the furthest Western team in Europe that qualified for it, now sent to the furthest Eastern destination location for it. So it's a 5,500-mile round trip in a European tournament. And it just, it right from the get-go, it seemed like an absolute absurdity. However, having said all that, I booked the tickets and then started looking last summer, obviously, when we thought it was going to be, sort of started looking at what the flight situation was. That was rubbish because there's only one direct flight a week from the UK. So it's a really difficult place to get to. One of the major hub airports is Istanbul. We were playing Turkey in the second game. So that was going to be an incredibly busy route in the build-up and the aftermath of that particular game. And then there was a short turnaround to get to Rome as well. So it just looked like, in terms of, if for France, drove over, I'd hired a camper van, which I picked up in France, and we drove. I mean, even that was a bit of a mad tournament because instead of staging it in single group sections, we were up and down the country constantly for 2 or 3 weeks, north to south and north to south. So there's a load of driving for that, but it paled into absolute insignificance against the lunacy of this particular tournament. So it was looking very problematic anyway, and then they delayed it for the year and nothing's got easier since, has it? So then you started to factor in, you know, the testing regime, the potential for being in quarantine in Baku in Azerbaijan. If you failed the test on the way back, you were there for 10 more days. And if you failed it again, you're there for another 10 days. You know, you could still be living in Baku, basically. So that you just looked at every complication. So that eventually it got to, they offered a refund, I guess. So I kept the tickets until the very last minute, just on the, I just didn't want to give them up because that was the end of it then. And then I got to that final point, but I think it was on the final day that I could refund them, and I pressed refund and they went. So
the dream died.
That was it. It's gone then. So I still had a Rome ticket though. A pal of mine had bought two tickets and he had one of them, which was for me. Then I went and I thought, Rome, maybe something will have changed by then. Because we had this constantly, and now, as we're sitting here now, there could be more changes in the next few hours in terms of where you can and can't go. So you have this constant change around in terms of what's on red, green, amber, whatever list, quarantining rules and all the rest of it. So I was on the off chance that this might change. I booked tickets for Rome. Ryanair was selling tickets for £30 from Manchester. So I thought, right, well, it's nothing to lose, frankly. I've got the tickets, I booked the flights, and it was out on the day of the game early and then back the following morning early. So less than 24 hours in Italy, but it got you from Manchester to Rome. And then we got closer to it and nothing changed. And then actually the Italians introduced an automatic 5-day quarantine for those arriving in Italy, which initially was going to be from the Saturday ahead of the game. Then they shifted it to the Monday after the game. But the constant sort of list of things that you needed to do. For less than 24 hours in Italy, you'd have to test before you went, quarantine for up to 10 days, test on day 2, test on day 8, potential test and release on day 5. You add the the cost of all of that as well. And it just, you know where I'm heading here.
Yeah.
You just get to the point where you go, I can't justify it. Plus, as a freelance, that quarantine period is significant because if anyone comes and asks me to do anything in that meantime and I'm stuck at home, I can't do it. So it inhibits my opportunity to work. And if Wales progress in the tournament, that will be another problem for me because I've got a date lined up in July where somebody wants me to do something. So that I've got to keep that 10-day, well, we're there now basically, aren't we? We're almost at that 10-day period leading up to that now. If Wales progress and where they ended up.
Semi-final at Wembley.
Well,
those are the words I was going to throw
at you. That works. That works for me. I can do that.
Who would you like to face at Wembley?
Anybody, because we fear nobody. And if we actually got to that stage, like the last time in 2016, doesn't really matter. Some things haven't changed. It's really interesting in Welsh football. You've got a generation of people like me who had been through the mill constantly and sort of following Wales and those who came before me, hoping they were going to qualify, seeing them fail, sometimes gloriously, sometimes far less than gloriously, at the final hurdle, happened so many times. There's so many injustices have been, to us at least, sort of perpetrated upon Welsh football. So we didn't get there. And then we got to this point where we qualified. And now, we still cling on to the memory of how we were always failing. So the older ones amongst us.
It's like Leeds.
It's very similar. In fact, you hang on to that. So you would always, you never have that supreme confidence. You know that thing where they go up and the Vox Pop thing where they ask people before the game, how do you think your team's going to do today? And they go, we're going to win 3-0. And I always look at those and I wince. How could you bring yourself to say that on camera? Everybody's seen you say that your team's going to win 3-0. It's going to be easy. And then you lose. It's literally your fault. I've held that with me for all my life. So if anybody's ever asked me, what's your score prediction today? I go, I don't really do predictions. All right. Draw. That's as far as I'll go with it. But that's inbuilt with this whole Wales thing, because we've just, pessimism goes with the territory for us lot, the old ones. Now you've got this new generation who've come through of fans who saw us qualify heading into 2016. And lo and behold, then we got very close in the World Cup qualification group, came within a game of qualifying there, at least for the playoffs. Then we've won the Nations League. We've won our Nations League group in the last round, which people are actually forgetting. We're now in the top tier of the Nations League now, and we're in the European Championships, and we've gone through the group stages. You've now got young fans who think this is normal, and they have expectation levels now. So you go and ask them before a game, do you think we'll win 3-0? You know, what do they think the score? They'll definitely say, I think we'll win 3-0. And you can't really fault them for it, but they just haven't suffered. They don't have the
terrifying
scars.
It's terrifying, isn't it?
They don't bear the mental anguish and all the rest that the rest of us have gone through, which is brilliant. And I'm really happy that that's the case, because it's actually very important, I think, for Welsh football anyway, that there is this, that you get as dinosaurs kind of, you know, shunt us to one side kind of thing. I mean, we're loving it, by the way. And I've got friends who are absolutely, go everywhere, literally everywhere with Wales, you know, the four corners of the earth, every single game. This is really hurting them, the fact that they can't go. I mean, I know a number who are in Baku, who, because of the quarantine, couldn't go to Rome because they've come back to the UK. And that, you know, these guys go everywhere, and to be kept away from this thing that they've waited all their lives to enjoy. We don't know. As we're sitting here now, we don't know whether Denmark might be the last game that Wales ever play in a summer tournament.
There's that pessimism.
Yeah. Well, yeah. But because we still don't have the, ask a young one, they'll say, oh, we'll be fine, we'll be in the next one in Germany or the World Cup in Qatar or whatever.
Yeah.
But for those of us, that's the sense of loss here is, are we ever going to enjoy this again? Are we ever going to have this opportunity again?
It is like Leeds. The parallels are uncanny. They really are. Because I think as you get older, you start to have that wider perspective on your whole life, don't you? And you realise that it's all finite. And, you know, when I was 21 or 22, whatever, and we're in the Champions League, this is going to last forever. Yeah. I've said before on podcasts, I said to one of my mates, Leeds will never get relegated now. Now we're up in the top four or five and we've got all this money coming in. And then you realise another 20 years down the line, what an idiot you were.
Well, it's the full package, isn't it? It's football and it's life.
Yeah.
Because at that age, at 21, you're thinking, right, I'm absolutely on my way to the top here. It's all fitting into place nicely. And then, you know, 10 years down the line, I'm not quite where I was anticipating I was going to be. Another 10 years after that, you're thinking, oh my God, where am I going here? And so the two things tend to Who remains a supreme optimist? I've just had my 52nd birthday. You know, each one that goes by now, you just chips away a little bit at that sort of.
If you are listening and you're in your 20s, it's great, honestly.
There's absolutely nothing to look forward to.
It gets easier to take. I think that's all I can say. The disappointments you can roll with them.
Because you accept that that's now part of life. And actually, it's a really bad thing in a way. So I've walked away. I was at the Wales-Romania game, a very famous game in Welsh football history, when we were one game away from the World Cup in the States, and we needed a result in that final game at home against Romania to ensure that we went to the World Cup. Before that match, I was in a pub called the O'Anglin Glyndŵr in the centre of Cardiff. People who've been the Millennium and stuff will know it. It's very near to the stadium. And I was in there. We were playing at the Arms Park in those days, and I was up on the bench seats. Everyone was singing. We're on the march with Terry's Army, Terry Yorath, obviously, Leeds connection, and we're all going to the USA. Everybody in the room was singing that song before the game. And then obviously we went one down, we equalised in the second half, immediately got given a penalty kick, and Paul Bowden stepped up, and anybody in my age even struggles to talk about it now, took the penalty, hit the crossbar. And that was the end of that.
Mm.
We ended up losing the game 2-1. All the dreams of that World Cup just collapsed
It's sounding very Watford playoff, is this? Jubilant scenes in Cardiff.
Well, I was going to say, when you said Cardiff, then I started having PTSD.
It is that sort of thing, because then you think, right, well, I will never... And this is, absolutely is the case for me. And I think if you ask lots of Wales fans, again, of my age, they'd probably say the same thing. I made a conscious decision at that point. I was in my early 20s living in Leeds. I just moved to Leeds and all the rest of it. So I'd driven down from Leeds with mates to watch that game. And I made a conscious decision from that point on, I'm never going to let myself get that carried away over a game of football again. Straight up, genuinely, that I would never throw myself into it to that level. Because it was such a crashing come down. It's actually affected the entire rest of my life. I maintain that game. So that innate pessimism that I have, I would point, if a psychologist or psychiatrist asked me, I would point to that night in Cardiff as the point at which I said, that's it, I can't be like that anymore. So I always now have that sense of, no, it probably won't happen.
It's so funny you two would get on really, really well talking about this sort of stuff, because you're the two most pessimistic people I've ever met. Actually, come to think of it.
Where do you strike the balance, I'm interested to know, with club football and supporting Wales? Because I feel like we are both quite...
Well, massive. I mean, to me, it's 90% Leeds, 10% England, if that.
Yeah, certainly when I was younger, I think I was probably more into England than I am now. And I think for me, sort of 98 World Cup was probably my most invested, though 96, 98 were the tournaments I was most invested in. And since then, I've swung so massively towards Leeds. But it feels like with you, you're more of a 50-50 split on it.
Oh, I'd say it's probably more than 50-50, frankly. And I don't know why that, maybe because my club side has been, well, for the last 13, 14 years, you know, rubbish, basically. Not to put too fine a point on it. So there's not been a challenge. You've been looking for some... a path to glory. You're always looking, as a football fan, you want a route to glory, don't you? You want those games, those moments.
Hope. It's hope, that, isn't it?
But it's the opportunity to celebrate something as well. Because again, as you get older, you realise that, you know, you've done marriage, you may have done divorce or whatever it is. You've got the kids and they're growing up, and mine have now basically left home. So all those things disappear. So you still need that thing where you think, ah, yeah, but if this goes well, this would be brilliant, wouldn't it? If we actually did, and then we're all, oh, I'd love it if that happened. So if you've got one of my outlets for that is Wrexham. Well, I'm at the point now, I've got to the point where, until very recently, where you think, yeah, it's not really happening, is it? So Wales has become the other one. So every qualification tournament, you start off thinking, this will be the one. This is going to be the one. And then you're two games in and you've lost them both. And already the qualification campaign's over. I wrote a diary, as I mentioned, of that first one when we did qualify. But actually, I'd started that diary about three or four times previously. And I've got the start of the draft. And it gets to game two. And we've lost it. And it's like, right, tear that one up. That one goes away. So I'd been at that position of knowing there's a massive story to happen here, potentially. But never getting to the point where I had the chance to write it until finally we did do that. So for me, that the international thing, I really enjoy. And it's the trips away, which hopefully Leeds are going to enjoy that opportunity to travel, just to travel and see different places. And I've done a lot of travelling as a fan with Wales as well as working on Wales games. So I've enjoyed both aspects of that.
It seems the travelling aspect with Wales is a lot easier than doing it with England as well. There's not the grief that you...
There's
that
an important.
Kind of
I think there's an important aspect to what you said, Michael. I have loads of Leeds mates who don't really follow England, and they're not, I would say, not really that bothered. And the only time I've seen a real interface for this was in Lons in the Euro 2016 tournament when Wales played England, obviously. And that was the only day in that entire tournament where there was an air of aggression, if that's the right word, kind of there was an edge around the game. And, you know, it was all, there was supposed to be an alcohol ban in Lons and all the rest of it. And the whole thing was an absolute carnival from start to finish for us Wales fans. But England had already had the big run in with the Russians in Marseille. Then it was Wales they were playing against. So there was an edge to all of that stuff. There was a couple of some sort of, it kicked off once or twice there. Wasn't too bad, but there was an atmosphere that wasn't present at any other game in that tournament. And after that match, we were sat, me and my pal, again from Leeds, were sat in the middle of, I think we stayed in Arras, I think we stayed ahead of that game, or Amiens, somewhere like that. So we'd gone back there after the game. We were sitting there just having a drink in the middle of town, and some England lads came up and said, oh, can we join you? So they sat down, we had a chat. They hadn't been to the game, they'd been to the fan zone to watch it. And then they started their own discussion about amongst themselves about the fact that wherever England went, there was trouble. And then one of them said, because one or two of them were justifying the fact that it's not England's fault, done it. And then he said, we always say that though, don't we? We always say it's somebody else's fault. And I still struggle to comprehend that whole England away thing, that whole, I don't, A good point was made by a pal of mine who said when Wales went away, if you went to a pub, and we'd colonise pubs like everybody does in the sort of square or whatever, but if you walk past it, everybody, you'd only see backs when you walk past it, because it's all people standing there chatting to each other, maybe singing or whatever, but they're all looking at each other. If you walk past the same place and England have taken it over, you see faces because everybody's staring out from the place, looking out onto the square. And it's a little tiny thing, but it's like you're here. Are you here to register your presence to everybody else to say, come and have a go if you want? Or are you just here to have a chat with your mates ahead of this game that you're all really looking forward to?
It's strange, isn't it? I quite like the fact that Leeds away games have got a bit of an edge, and because it feels like you're part of something, but I don't like the same thing with England. It's strange. I don't know if that makes me a hypocrite or what.
There's that invading army aspect, and everyone loves getting off a train in huge numbers, and you're in the station, and the noise echoes around the roof, and you pile out the station onto the street, and it feels like you own this place sort of thing. There's a great shared experience in that. If you haven't been in the midst of it, you might hate it, but lots of us enjoy it. But it's where you go from, where you go with the next stage of that. And the further away from, the bit that really, really puzzles me with the England thing is you travel great distances to hate people. Why go that far? You can kind of do that on your own doorstep. But why?
Throw patio furniture at home.
I do, and I love it.
I do, that's the bit I really, really struggle to comprehend. Why do you want to go away and make people not like you? And there are loads of England fans who don't do that. I'm absolutely, utterly aware of that. But there are a significant number still who do have that as part of the motivation. And that's the bit I absolutely don't get. Because if you've been away as a travelling fan, you'll know. I mean, I went the first time I ever went with Wales to Nuremberg to watch us get thrashed by Germany. But after that match, we got legged through the city centre by East German loonies. It was just after the Germany, West Germany became Germany and East Germany. So they'd taken it as an opportunity, and it was a UK team effective that was being played. So, and it was scary, Why would you want to be a long way from home and in that situation where loads of people want to have a go at you? That's the bit that I don't get that one.
Well, Phil's probably at home in bed now with a big bandage on his head following his surgery. However, we bring him to you now from the past. We recorded this a little while ago before he went into hospital. His top 10 signings since 2006, the 15 years in which you've been covering Leeds United, Phil. So far, we've had Kisnorbo, Snoddy, Becchio, Cooper, Rafinha, and then Jermaine Beckford took the number 5 slot last week. Who's your number 4?
Okay, caveat here, because Michael's going to have a pop, but the next three on this list are kind of joint second in that it's very difficult to put a cigarette paper between them. And I think your appreciation of their value would probably depend on the point in time at which we were talking about them. So if you went back to last season, you might position one above another and so on. They're kind of interchangeable and fluid. But at number 4, I've gone for the man that I called the T-1000 from Terminator a while back, Stuart Dallas.
What has Stuart Dallas brought to Leeds United? I mean, I said at the time when we spoke about Dallas, when you called him the T-1000, when we signed him for a long while, I wasn't quite sure what he was, what we were supposed to be getting out of him, because in my mind he was a winger, but he's never turned out to be that.
No, he certainly was when he signed, and that was where he played initially under Uwe Rosler. And he's spent several years being an integral member of the squad without ever sort of finding his niche and finding a permanent position to play in. I think he's undoubtedly brought versatility, and that goes without saying. You can see that just from the range of positions that he's played with. But I also think he's brought an attitude of attainment and aspiration. I think he really embodies the way in which players under Bielsa have elevated themselves and have gone beyond what people perceived previously to be their limits. I don't know if you went back 2 or 3 years whether anybody watching Leeds would necessarily have considered Dallas to be a future Premier League player in the way that the same could have been said probably about people like Liam Cooper and Luke Ayling and others. It's been a very gradual thing with Dallas, but it's also been a story of somebody who has improved every time Leeds have improved and has always been there every time they've improved. And a player who Bielsa goes to all the time, plays so regularly. I think it goes a little bit unnoticed this and a little bit under the radar. But if you look at Dallas's appearances, particularly in the season when they were promoted, Bielsa basically used him whenever he could. He always found a position for him in the team. He was his right back. He was his left back. He would use him in midfield when there were issues with selection there. And latterly, for him to become a first choice midfielder, which isn't even central midfielder, which isn't even what anybody would consider to be his recognised position in a season in a higher division and in one of the best divisions in the world, it says an awful lot about not only his ability to adapt, but also his self-confidence, because I don't think it would be possible to change position as much as he does and to be as good as he's been without believing that you can actually do it.
Do you agree with our mate Moscow White, who said that the penny dropped with fans when it came to Dallas, that second leg of the Derby playoff semi-final at Elland Road?
I certainly think there's something in that. He'd looked like the only player on that evening who was going to drag Leeds through, and it probably is still one of, if not his best performance for the club, despite the result and despite what went on. I think he'd become influential before then in Bielsa's mind and had been a very strong part of the team, but in quite an understated way, in quite a quiet way. It was never spectacular with Dallas. You could almost go without noticing him because your attention was always fixed on Hernandez or Kamal Roof, as it was, and then obviously Bamford after that. But I think for Dallas, the penny for him really dropped in the summer when Bielsa came. People at the club talk about him and Cooper, they're very, very close friends and the partners are very close as well, spend a lot of time together. Deciding prior to Bielsa arriving in England that they were going to cut out all alcohol from the diet. They didn't drink a lot because players don't these days, but they were going to stop completely. And they were going to kind of change the way they looked after themselves because they knew what was coming. Now, they'd read enough or they'd heard enough about Bielsa to know that it was going to be extremely intense and parts of it were going to be hell. And you either got up to speed with it very quickly or you would drift away. And I think that helped to make them big players in Bielsa's eyes. I think he likes their attitude anyway. I think he likes their effect on the dressing room and their general mood and general demeanour. They're very coachable players, very easy to manage, never a problem and never an issue. But they are core members of this squad. They're the senior players. They're the sort of players that Leeds would speak to first when, for example, the COVID wage deferral. You know, both of them were involved in those talks because both of them are seen as very senior members of the squad and very influential members of the squad. But you have to say with Dallas, in absolutely no way is he a cheerleader. He's in the team on merit and he's been as good under Bielsa as just about anybody else.
How good is Stuart Dallas then, and does he deserve his place as number four in this list?
I think maybe he deserves to be higher given the season he's had this year. But I
told you.
I'm not sure how good he is because he keeps getting better. I'm unsure of where his ceiling is because he moves around positions and he plays incredibly well wherever he goes, it seems. I remember going back to Bielsa's first season, he might have been one of, if not the first game, certainly one of the first games he played at fullback for us, and he was at right back away at Blackburn and we lost. And he looked a little bit out of his depth there. He got skinned a few times and I think we probably talked about it afterwards and were saying like, well, he's probably not really a fullback. I'm not sure he's necessarily got the skills to play there. Bielsa kept playing him there. He kept getting better there. And the same thing has happened with him in midfield. He just, to the point now where he looks, if you watched a game, you wouldn't for a second guess that that wasn't his first choice position. So I'm interested to see what happens. I think he can probably keep going as this team improves. I think he can probably try and stay in it.
Somebody said to me after the Blackburn game, he was playing as a false two in the sense that it didn't seem like there was actually a right back on the pitch. But I was just going to say to answer the question of how good is he? Who the hell knows? I mean, it seems as if every time you think he must have just about peaked or reached his limit, he gets better and better. And I think, I'm not saying it's easy to play at fullback, but I reckon it's easier to adapt and be decent in those positions than it is to adapt and be extremely effective as a centre mid. And I think the fact that he is now looking like first choice centre mid or one of them at Leeds tells you that he's gone up a notch again.
A great footballer and a damn good human being as well. Stuart Dallas takes the number four slot on Phil's top 10 signings since 2006. Paddy Kisnorbo at 10, Robert Snodgrass at 9, Becchio at 8, Cooper 7, Rafinha 6, Beckford 5, Dallas 4, into the top 3 when you join us next week. To the football aspect of it then, and in particular a Leeds United lens, Tyler Roberts hasn't really featured at all, has he, for Wales. Can you give us an insight into what the view of Tyler Roberts is from a Wales perspective?
He's still doing exactly with Wales, I think, what he's trying to do with Leeds United, which is establish his credentials effectively. And he had a really good run in the side, obviously, at the back end of last season. I was so happy when he got that, when he finally got the goal, because it hadn't become a joke, but it was a thing around the commentary and stuff that, you know, is Tyler ever going to score kind of thing. But he got his opportunity. He got a good run out on the side. So I wasn't at all surprised that he then got offered the contract extension. But I think in a way, with Wales like Leeds, he's trying to, I think still people are maybe trying to work out where he plays, basically. And the way that Wales play, there are other people in that kind of position. If he's sort of playing in the hole, you've got, you know, when Ramsey's fit, you've got, he's a top quality international player. So he's likely to be in that position, or Bale sometimes will play in that floating position. So I think the competition's quite fierce for Tyler to actually say what Wales actually lack is a striker. So they've got Kiefer Moore, but as evidenced in the last game against Italy, when they didn't start with Kiefer Moore, there isn't another striker. Well, there is, but he's 17 years old, the one in the squad. So there is a role for Tyler there, but he's not. I don't think he's perceived as a striker, is he? So that's where he's going to find it may be difficult to get in this tournament, or has found it difficult to get game time. The fact he's there is good, because from my selfish Welsh perspective, the more of those players, he's next generation, Tyler, for sure. Listen, this place is definitely there in the Welsh squad, because your Bales and your Ramseys and your Allens are all getting that little bit older. They might be around for Qatar. It's unlikely they'll be around for the next European Championships. So this group we've got is a really young group, youngest squad, I think, in the tournament. So Tyler's part of that group that's evolving. So he's been with the group, and no group of young Welsh players has had this opportunity before to learn what tournament football's like. We've never had a generation that's had that opportunity. So Tyler's part of that group. So his time will definitely come. Just might not be this time, I suspect.
There were probably some serious questions asked about Tyler Robertson, whether he had a future at Leeds around the turn of the year, coming into the final year of his contract. But he's signed an extension now. Do we expect to see him kick on then, do you think, in the next year or two?
Well, that has to be the expectation, doesn't it? That's the whole point of the process. And I think that's why, like I say, when he was getting games at the end of last season, clearly Marcelo Bielsa has identified that there's a place for him in that group. So he used the opportunity, I think, over those final few games of the season to sort of test things out and to have a... Because the one thing Tyler had lacked from the time he's been at Leeds from the beginning, isn't it, is that concerted run of games. So that run of games became his longest run of consecutive starts since he's been at Leeds United. And he's been around quite a while in comparative terms now. So he figures, you know, and he's had his contract and they like him. Clearly, he's a good member of the group. He knows how the system works, which I think is important. So you would anticipate that there's something for him there next season.
Did you enjoy the end of the season then? We had Mr. Dorigo in your sidekick some weeks ago, and he was giving off the impression that it was a nice time you were having.
It was a nice time we had from day one till day whatever it was, day 38. It was brilliant. And the way that Leeds finished was really, really encouraging. It's easier to do the non-pessimism bit if you're I'm highly invested in it, but not like, it's not like, you know, the next level invested in it. I can sit slightly more dispassionately and say, I think Leeds could do really well next season. And I still got slightly nervous saying stuff like that. But if you were assessing it and the way that Leeds finished and the way that you saw players emerge who you think can become even better players. So Llorente, even in flashes, Koch, and those lads who, you know, what Rafinha had done through the season and what Rodrigo started to do in that back end, you thought there's some good players here. Plus the ones who are already here, who've had a really great season, you know, sort of standout seasons for the likes of Bamford, Ayling, Dallas, people like that. If you keep all of them together and add two or three more in those positions, I think everybody knows what the positions that Leeds need to recruit in. If you add to that, I would say this looks like a good squad to me.
And as an eternal pessimist as well. Two of you sat in the room. Do you think the Premier League holds fear for Leeds next season or not? You said they could do well.
I don't think it should do. From what I've seen last season, I don't think the Premier League, and that's what was that you asked about the run in the final few matches. That was the great bit of that, because they took on some of the bigger teams, obviously going to away at the Etihad, and then I thought the Man United draw at home was a really good performance. I enjoyed that game a lot. But they played against some of the teams that they need to be getting points off if they're going to do anything a little higher up the table. And only a little higher up the table means sort of a push at least for Europe next season. I mean, if you look at it, the Brighton result, Leeds with that Brighton result away from actually going into the final weekend with the potential to finish in a European place. So that was the one blip in that final run-in. But everything else I saw at that stage, I liked what I saw. Mm-hmm. You know, they just got better and better. And all this nonsense that had been talked about, the fact that they were going to be burnt out and all the rest of it, was proved to be just that, absolute nonsense.
I think, It's moved on to the second season thing now, hasn't it? With people saying, well, Sheffield United did well. But equally, Sheffield United finished the season badly, didn't they, the year before? And they went into the new season with absolutely no momentum, without having strengthened, with a team that were generally their best players were getting older. And, and whereas ours, it feels like...
I love it you two are trying to convince one another.
They should all be at least as good as last season, shouldn't they? With the ages of them, we've not got an aging Pablo Hernandez anymore that we're trying to build a team around. That you're thinking, can he drag another year out of himself? Like they should all be kind of in their peak.
Well, and with Sheffield United, you looked at the group and you thought the one thing that seems to be lacking there is the recruitment aspect of that, and that's what Leeds did well last summer, because although you didn't see as much of those players as you'd have liked, maybe. But the bits you did see give you a strong sense that they are going to improve the squad. You know, if they stay fit, they'll be good players for Leeds United. So if you can add two or three to that, you've then got this quite a core group then that all look like they are proper Premier League players. And if you ally to that the nous and the know-how of the man in charge and their drive, the players, their own drive as well, the fact they didn't let up at any stage in that back end of last season, even when they knew the job was done, I think it bodes well, very well. I think it bodes very well for next season.
Choosing your words carefully. Yeah. I could just see that I don't want to be too optimistic.
Well, do you know, I was thinking when Marcelo Bielsa's the third anniversary of his announcement of his arrival was made, I'd done another podcast in the run up to that, when the speculation was around the Leeds podcast, and somebody had asked me about it, and I'd said something along the lines of, but he doesn't know the Championship, does he? I wasn't alone in saying that, but I have that phrase, it still rolling my, I think somebody's going to just pull that out. Every time this anniversary comes round, somebody's just going to pull that out and throw it, you know, chuck it in front of me. I know it's there out there somewhere kind of thing. So you're always slightly nervy, you're getting haunted by the bold predictions you make one way or another, but I'll still make it. I think Leeds United could do really well next season.
It's going to help having the crowds back in as well, isn't it? It's an obvious thing to say. It's a thing we've touched on plenty.
Is it?
I think so, yeah. Are you one of those, they'll get on the players' backs, make them nervous? I think it's going to be a great healing, and I think there's still a lot of love and celebration to give out.
Oh, no question about that.
From the promotion.
Yeah. I mean, that last game was fantastic. That was really emotional inside the stadium for that last game, just to hear some noise inside the stadium. I mean, that made a difference. There's one or two aspects of it that could be really helpful. The noise when you're chasing a goal late on, that kind of thing, to drive. Not that these players actually really need driving on. I think they've proved that time and time again. But it could help in terms of it being a different atmosphere to lots of other Premier League grounds, where it's all tends to be quite quiet and sterile these days because they're super grounds, but nobody makes any noise in them, which obviously won't be at all the case at Leeds United. As long as there is also that goes with that willingness to be patient or understanding of, because it's been posited that Pat Bamford had a great season because there weren't people in the stadium, that might have helped him in terms of the decision making, you know, and not chasing things that he wouldn't chase if somebody wasn't about to howl at him for not doing it or whatever. So there is that. There is you can't not have fans in, by the way. I'm not advocating that at all. And I do think, on the balance of probability, it should be
nice
a positivity.
To them. Just be nice to them.
Be nice, because they absolutely deserve to feel the love, because they have been absolutely magnificent. I mean, I've enjoyed watching and being around that group as much as any group I've ever, you know, had the privilege to watch over a regular period in the past. That they are a fantastic group.
And the football as well. I mean, it must be such a thrill to commentate on football like that.
It's ruined me for everything else. I've said this all along. It's ruined me for watching other matches now, because I look at them and I go, well, where's your fullbacks? Why aren't,
as England for us. That's part of the reason.
Why aren't they on the edge of the penalty area now? Where are they? Why are you not chasing him back? And I tell you, it's because I saw quite a lot of Wrexham at the back end of the season, because we were doing the streaming coverage of the game. So I was there I was lucky enough to be in the ground to watch those matches. I mean, obviously, it's a completely different level anyway, but it's not actually about the level for me. It's about the application. And I don't think there's any reason why a player in the National League can't, at the very least, do the same amount of running as a player at Leeds United does. And that would go to every position between the two clubs, frankly. That's what fans actually demand, is that you've got a corner kick and 10 seconds later you're on the edge of the opposition penalty area. That's what fans want from you, because that is you putting everything into it. Now, you can be the worst footballer in the world, but at the very minimum, if you put that much into it, then you're doing something right.
Yeah.
And that's the bit, actually, that I find hardest, in a sense, to not see with other teams, is when you think, well, I've seen Leeds doing this week in, week out, so
why aren't you?
Yeah. That has been a frustration watching England, that you end up watching it like Bielsa on the sideline, kind of, move. you're wanting someone to... It's like, just pick up the ball and run someone. It's how we scored the other day, is that Saka did it. He just got the ball and thought, well, I'm just going to set off and see where this takes me. Yeah. And it feels like no one does it for England. And we've become so accustomed to watching it. And there was, I think it was in the first game when it was a cleared corner and there was Sterling and Foden with the ball and no one was up with them. And you're just so used to Leeds when there are six men all charging forward and there's still three defenders there because they're all still trying to get up to attack the corner. And I think... I just dread the day that ends because it's so exciting to watch, and we almost take it for granted now. I think that's just the way we play.
Well, I've noticed when I'm doing the commentaries that my voice level rises if Leeds clear a corner kick, because then you're already anticipating what might come next. And if I don't have that same level of anticipation from the other team that I'm watching, whoever that might be, then there's an element missing there for me now.
Do you listen to yourself back ever?
It's actually quite hard to avoid it these days because we've talked about the sort of slightly strange mix between it's an audio and a visual commentary, in a sense, because it goes to different audiences, but at different times. So lots of it comes back in the form of the clipped up versions that the club uses on social media and stuff. Mm. So I do.
I meant from like an analysis point of view. Do you ever sit back and give yourself an air check?
I didn't used to because I didn't like doing it, but I do a bit now just to see what works and what doesn't. I know what works and what doesn't, but just to kind of confirm in my own mind sometimes what works and what doesn't. So when they do, I wouldn't sit back ever and listen to the whole game because that would be very dull and self-indulgent. But I will listen, like, because you actually earn your money with it, with the highlighty bits, you know. So they put the little highlights package out that everybody can get access to on YouTube, that 3-minute, I think it has to be a 3-minute package. So they put those out and I will look back at those, and I will actually, I'll read the comments as well. I have to admit,
don't do it
as well.
Don't
well, do it. You need to know. For better or for worse, shall we say. So it's quite, I mean, it's fantastic to read where they're coming from, by the way, because they're coming from, you know, this is the difference, by the way, chaps.
Yeah.
This is Championship to Premier League.
Well, it's funny, we spoke to you in the wake of getting promoted, I think it was, wasn't it, around that time? Oh, no, it was before that, I think, when we were still recording over at Radio Air, and you said the difference in the media and the response and the scale of it in the Premier League is unknowable. And then actually now within it, you see it, don't you? It's mad.
Everybody's got a comment about Leeds United, and that's on a global footing now. So you look at that, if you go through those YouTube comments, you see lots of them are in Spanish, for instance, or loads of different languages.
Make sure you commentate in Spanish, don't you, sir?
I'll give it a go, man. See. And that's the brilliant aspect of it. And something like the Man City highlights, that little 3-minute highlights reel, got a million plus views. So the numbers just start growing and everything just gets that much bigger. And the great thing from Leeds' perspective is, the bad thing is, they've not had the chance to tap into it over the last 12 months. The great thing is that opportunity still lies ahead, frankly. And what's happened over the season is the football's been so good and they've been such a great story that, as I understand it, there's loads of commercial interest in Leeds United now. So that should help drive this thing forward to make sure that Leeds start to attain that next level status that, you know, that's the challenge that lies ahead now.
From a commentary perspective, I mean, Wales have got Denmark in the round of 16. Christian Eriksen and what happened there. Did you look at any of that, whether at the time or later on, from a commentator's perspective, and how you handle something as extraordinary as that?
Well, I always had in my head when I was doing live games, and I've told people about this before, particularly doing things like Soccer Saturday, that you have to always plan for the worst case scenario. And the worst case scenario in any situation, live situation like that, is sadly, quite frankly, somebody dropping dead on the pitch. And, you know, that was the situation that almost played out in that game. So that's why if I look to great pieces of commentary, I'd say, oh, you know, X doing goal, da da da. But one of the great pieces of commentary, there's two fantastic pieces of commentary, if that's the right word. And one of them is John Helm commentating on the Bradford Fire.
Yeah, goodness me.
Which is incredible. And also Peter Jones at Hillsborough on the day of the Hillsborough disaster. And those two, because that's the point. You go to cover a football match. Covering football is relatively easy because it's, great, da-da-da. But all of a sudden, when you've got to change completely like that and you've got to hit a new set of levels here, and the tone has got to be markedly different, incredibly, like you wouldn't believe different. That's the bit that you do actually have to prepare for. You think it will never happen, but you have to be ready in case it does. And the, one of the things that slightly concerns me when I saw more and more footballers, for instance, now being asked to report on football, is that what you're doing when you ask them to do that job is you are neglecting to cover that journalistic aspect to this thing, which might require them to be talking in ways that they have never talked before and not used to talking in. Because anybody who goes into a live sport, live football situation, this could happen, because the whole point is literally anything can happen. So usually you'd hope it would be Chris Kamara missing a sending off type thing, but that there is a, you know, there is something, there's a Christian Eriksen moment in any game as well, potentially. And that's the bit where you need to know that the people you've got covering this thing understand the gravitas required and will make use the right phrases and all the rest of it. Mm. I was out watching the Wales game, so I didn't see the coverage around. I know there was a suggestion they stayed on the pitches too long and there were too many pitches, but it's a tricky one because you've got Gary Lineker, ex-footballer, and then they've got three pundits in the studio with him, are all ex-footballers. And I think they did, from what I read, they did. I can't comment because I didn't see it, but it's a tricky one, you know, that, and you need to be prepared for that. And I'd say that to a pundit, if I do some bits of work with people who fancy having a crack at punditry, I'd say that to them, that you've got to be ready to change pace here, change the tone here, potentially. I mean, it was bad stuff, obviously, but thankfully he's okay in relative terms. And then football just rolls on, doesn't it? Incredible.
Yeah, it always does.
They even played the ruddy game straight off the back of it. You know, it's just, wow, how we seem to just compartmentalise things in football so quickly. Yeah, terrible, terrible. Right then, should we get on? Okay, goal kick, isn't it? Okay, and off we go again. I mean, which is great in a way, because it heals itself constantly as a game, but in another way, it's like crackers. Come on, fellas.
It leaves Wales cast as the villains then for the next round. Well, it's unfamiliar territory.
It is. This is very unfamiliar territory. We won an award for being lovely fans at Euro 2016. Now, all of a sudden, everybody wants Denmark to win, and we've got no fans in the ground, and the Danes have got all our tickets instead, so they're going to have loads there. So, you know, and what did we do to deserve all of this? We were nice. We're nice people. why are you treating us like this? And everybody, obviously, I mean, I understand the sympathy vote kind of thing that Denmark have got, and good luck to them, but you know, doesn't make me not want us to beat them, obviously. Yeah.
And to circle back to where we started, maybe a semi-final at Wembley, and obviously as much as we've kind of said it's hard to get as invested in England as we do Leeds United by any stretch of the imagination, I'd love to see England Wales.
Oh, I wouldn't. No.
You've almost convinced me Wales should be allowed to win it.
Yeah, I'll have that.
You don't fancy England?
No, not at all. Because exactly the same as in Lons, it just becomes the whole packagey, baggagey thing where you can't really focus on the game or the experience. Going to Wembley, I've been to watch Wales at Wembley before, and the whole thing around it. Now, I definitely not that one for me. Thanks.
Well, good luck to Wales. I know you might not extend the same feelings back towards England, but
do you know what? I was born in England. I was born in Liverpool. I lived in England for the first 9 years of my life, and then I moved to Wales. And my mum's Welsh and a Welsh speaker and all the rest of it. And that's where the allegiance really comes from. But obviously I lived there for a number of years as well. But I don't have any, I can watch an England game and be completely neutral about it. I mean, in the old days, I'll hold my hands up here and don't tell anybody, but I might have celebrated when a team scored against England. But it is the olden days. Because after that, I thought, well, no, actually, I don't want England to do badly. I'm not bothered. I'm not bothered. So I watch England games in a state of sort of complete neutrality.
It's funny that, because that's what Phil said a little bit earlier on when we were talking to him, because he's kind of got English roots and you know, family and all the rest of it. And it's good to know that we're not all completely hating on each other in the UK anyway. Well, we can all be friends.
There are a few who will, and that's the bit that I'd say that's not do England Wales. England Scotland was funny on that basis when you've got all the Scots coming down to London and all the rest of it. But it's there's just too much other stuff goes with it. I don't need to know how much people hate Wales.
So then Saturday, tea time, lamb and flag?
Lamb and Flag is our destination of choice for the we've declared this it's the ancient Celtic kingdom of Elmet is this area, as I discovered very recently, and where I'm living is kind of on the borderland, but was at the heart of it, and so I've started to look around with slightly different place names and things with a slightly different perspective now. So I created a Wales banner, a Welsh dragon, to hang in the pub, which is a Wal Goch, which is the red wall, which is what they call the Wales fans, as a travelling body. And then at the bottom, it's got Elmet on it, because we are in the kingdom of Elmet as much as we're in the city of Leeds as well.
A Welsh enclave. Well, enjoy the match, Bryn, and best of luck, and we'll catch up with you soon. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
You're welcome.
If you want to subscribe to The Athletic, have a look at the very latest offer at theathletic.com/LeedsPod. We'll speak to you next week with John Richardson on The Phil Hay Show. See you in a bit.
The Phil Hay Show.